Well, hi, everybody. This is Dave. Welcome. How are you?
Doing great.
Great. Bring us up to date. Wins and progress notes.
This is Terry Finney.
Look forward to your roadmap. That's really excellent, and I think it's going to be a treat to go over that. So thanks for
that. Yeah, I hope people learn from it.
Oh yeah,
because I definitely wrote from learning it.
Oh,
no major wins. Just really focused on marketing and putting a plan together for that.
Necessary, but less than exciting. But just really essential things, though. Did
right.
you find doing the roadmap useful to you?
Yeah, I did. You know, the thing that I found the most from putting that together is that working with this woman, it's not sequential. I mean,
oh yeah,
at all.
Uh-huh.
But it's been really helpful to her to have all the different pieces, and she's benefited. And I actually had a conversation with her today, and she's in such a good place with herself, which is a huge win. So that is a huge win.
You know, that's great, and that's such an interesting thing, and I think it's so true. And even though we have to talk about things in a linear and sequential way, it is anything but, because it's certainly a systematic way of looking at things, only to reduce it for purposes of discussion. Is it linear, or for purposes of putting it into a depiction like this? So that's a really excellent point, and I probably don't make that point enough, because we go through the modules, in sequential order. We do the exercises and the work pages for each one, but you know, it's certainly something that is anything but as we're working with clients. So really a good point, and mention that too as you put it together about how you came to that and how you saw that. So that's a really good point. Thanks.
Sure.
Who else?
Hello, Dave. This is Lalia. Just checking
Welcome.
In, saying hello.
How are you doing?
Oh, good. Hoping everybody's not too overfed,
yeah.
Like I am. Yeah.
So that's good. Any wins or progress notes for your coaching?
I'm meeting a potential new client. That's a big win for me, so that's exciting.
Share with us how you acquired the client. Inspired.
I acquired it by putting myself out there with my friends and telling them that I am looking for clients, and I instantly had somebody refer me. So that was a win. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
And think of doing that several times a week and really brainstorming to look at who you do that with and sending out letters of announcement and look at who your primary referral sources are and be sure that they know exactly what you do and how to refer to you and follow up each time they refer someone to you.
Yes.
And many of you have probably thought about this already, probably do it, but while coaching is a profession, it's also a business, and in the business world, referral fees are very traditional, and that's something that you may want to think about in terms of giving referral fees and getting referral fees. That can incentivize someone to refer to you.
That's a great idea. Actually, the person that referred me is doing a very unusual business where she's sort of trying to develop a referral business. So,
oh, even better.
So, in
yeah.
a sense, I might be her first client, and she's referred me to others. So, that's kind
Was
of
this
an,
a discussion that you and she had about a referral fee?
We had a discussion about how she would monetize her referral business, how she
uh-huh.
was going to structure that. And so, so in the meantime, she gave me this referral, but that was out of friendship
uh-huh.
and out of, actually I'm a mentor to her, so she...
Well, it's also a business, and it might be a good place to start. I think
it might be a great place to start.
A very standard referral fee is at least 10% of the fees. I do 10% of the first year's billing, or the first year's receipt. Now, usually coaching doesn't last that long, but I'm very happy to do that. My first referral fee payment was to the coach who mentored me and referred me someone who she had thought was a good client. So think about the referral fees.
That's a wonderful tip. That's a wonderful.
That's a great idea. I hadn't thought of that either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you might just mention to someone, you know, I do referral fee. I do 10% of the first year's billing, or whatever you've decided to do, 10 or 15% or whatever. The groups that you can't do that for, or that won't accept it, are healthcare professionals, attorneys, and CPAs. Now, but they can receive gifts, and I think it's really useful. Like one of my buddies here in Houston, who I did residency with, who's has a very big adolescent psychiatry practice, referred me someone, an attorney, and I sent him a gift basket of a bunch of bottles of wine and cheeses and stuff to his office. Mm-hmm. Now, there was a method to that, because a dozen of his therapists saw that I do referral gifts. So, plus it was, you know, and I've done things like for professionals who refer, like a gift certificate, you know, a $200 or $300, $400 gift certificate to a restaurant for referring someone. Because, you know, 10% may sound like a lot, but it's, you know, you get 90%. Otherwise, you wouldn't get anything. And 90% of anything is a lot better than 100% of nothing. So it's a very small PR and marketing fee, because we probably have very little PR marketing and advertising fees. Most may be for professional entertainment, like taking people to lunch or dinner. But I think it's a good idea. So just to think about.
Yeah, thank you. That's excellent.
Yeah. Who else? Anybody else want to check in?
This is Terry Holmes, and I'm here.
Okay, super. What's going on for you, Terry?
I've just been, actually in the last week, I've been spending some time looking into blogging and creating one and learning more about it and all of that. So that's what I've been up to.
I would highly recommend blogging. You've all heard me say, if I were going to start out right now with a coaching practice, the first thing I would do after letterhead stationery and a business card and a landline with a headset is a blog, because I think that it is one of the best ways you can get your information out there, to really be highly selective about what you do, and to have a blog branded and to have it specific about what you want to do and what you want to learn more about. And it's a great way to get your message out there, to go viral with things. I mean, it's a very useful way to learn more and to engage people to have a following. Who all does a blog?
I've started one, but I haven't followed through in a way that's probably effective.
Okay. I think it's useful to have a branded blog and a specific message that you're going to be writing, because once you decide what you're going to blog about, then you'll begin to see all kinds of things that are bloggable. Do Google alerts for the subjects that relate at all to your blogs to see what is out there, what people are writing about, and Google alerts will send you the links to everything from journal articles and newspaper articles to other blogs. The bottom half of the Google alerts that they send you each month will be for blogs, and that's how the blogs get disseminated. I know you've heard me say this, that it took me 4 months of doing a blog to get as many subscribers as it took me 4.5 years with a newsletter, doing all the right things, having the white papers on the website and that sort of thing. And I would do a blog before a website at the present time.
Wow.
Because the way that your blog gets disseminated is it gets picked up by blog search engines, and there are things you can do that get that done for free, and it'll be picked up by Google alerts when your titles are, you know, you have, like I have a, you know, I have, you know, a few dozen Google alerts that I get sent information, like neuroeconomics, for example. If there's the word neuroeconomics in the title or in the body of the blog, it'll appear the next morning in my Google alerts in the neuroeconomics with the title of the blog, a little abstract, and a link to it. And then people can go and sign up for it. And you can go to other blogs that relate and comment and get some cross-traffic. And I've had people who have called me to do coaching because of the blog.
Wow.
Anything else? Anybody else want to check in?
Hi, Dave. This is Mary Beth.
Welcome. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Just listening in on the interesting conversation. I have a public website that I've been attempting to try to set up blogging on, but somewhere along the road, I kind of switched over to my Facebook business page where I do some postings fairly frequently, and I'm trying to take the traffic from that and drive it back to my website
mm-hmm.
where they get, like, you know, just a synopsis of information on my Facebook business page, and then going, linking that to my website, then they get the more detailed information once they're over there.
Okay, great. How is that working?
It's a slow process, I can tell you that.
Uh-huh.
But I've had some really good responses with people in terms of building up an audience on my Facebook page. Like, not too long ago, I went out and announced to everybody that I was going through a campaign over the weekend to try to get a certain number of fans to drive traffic through my website. And once I attained the number, then I started putting out some posts that were pertinent to topics that I wanted to draw people's
uh-huh.
attention to. And
okay.
then it just generated quite a bit of communication. So that part was really good.
Well, good. Good. Yeah, look around at the blogs that you like, the ones that you follow, and see what grabs you about them. Writing a blog is a different kind of matter. You probably will want to do a short piece, 200, 300 words. The blog, it's really a kind of a newsletter, but it's you know, a good sample of what a newsletter or blog can be of CTA. You notice that every one of those has a format. It has kind of a theme in terms of coaching. It has a limit of 250, 275 words. When you do that with a blog, people will begin to know and trust you and begin to want to read what you have. And, you know, when you get the blog delivered to someone's mailbox, they don't have to think about going to your site and doing it, which is why it's way better than a newsletter. So you want to have a place for people to sign up that's very prominent. When I started to blog, I had Bill set up a free download of an interview of the book, The Secret Language of Money, that had just come out at that time, as an enticement to sign up for the my professional Facebook page. The blog stood alone. The blog happened. I was nudged by McGraw-Hill to start the blog before the book ever came out. But it's very useful to have the predictability and to develop the following, because here's the real benefit of what you can do. Once you have a following with the blog and they began to read what you do, then it's an easier step to what you may offer. You know, for example, the last time I offered a four-part teleseminar series under my umbrella, under Mentor Path, I put a little note, a couple of sentences at the bottom of the blog, and within the first 24 hours, I had 22 people who had signed up for it. So that's a real benefit as you develop a following. And like, I guess it's the most recent blog I announced the online retreat for money mastery, and that was very useful. So I think it's really useful. Mostly, it'll be fun doing it, and you want to write about what you most want to learn, and it can be really fun doing it. Anybody else want to check in before we go to Terry's roadmap? Any other things to mention or challenges or questions anyone has? Okay, well, Terry, let's do your roadmap.
Okay. This is a woman named Candace. She's 58. She came to me with symptoms of depression and had had kind of a traumatic stressor in her marriage that precipitated her entry into working with me. From the very beginning, little bit about her history I think would be helpful. She's been married for most of her life to a man who works for a multinational engineering company. So in their marriage, they have lived all over the world together, and then probably for the past 15 years, he's lived other places without her, spending time with her periodically, but she's pretty much stayed in the Denver area in their home, which is a nice home with horses and some property. So he's a cheater, been a cheater for a long time, and there was an incident in Chile that precipitated her coming in and saying, I'm just not sure I can do this anymore. So she's been great to work with because she, from the very beginning, was like, I need to figure out what I need to do. My life is a mess. And so in that way, I haven't had to kind of reorient her much to, you know, who's making the choices in her life. Although there has been a little bit of a, you know, I'm a victim of this cheating man. And what goes with that often, I find, is the story about I stayed because I had to raise the kids. So there's some of that in her story. But she was pretty interested in moving forward, and she's done that a lot. She's been great to work with. And one of the things that I was telling Dave in the very beginning, for those of you who weren't on yet, is that when I wrote this roadmap, what became really clear to me is that we haven't done anything. Well, the work that we've done hasn't been in a linear roadmap kind of fashion. I mean, we've used a lot of the concepts that we've been working on, but they've kind of woven through, you know, different content that she would bring in or different places where she's in her life. So it hasn't been really a very linear process. So she's described her work as unmuddling, figuring out what to do. And one of the things that I have helped her to do is to get as much information as she can. I mean, the major thing that she needs to do is figure out whether she's going to stay married or get divorced. And in my mind, that'd be a pretty easy choice, but it's not me who's making the decision. And so she's had a lot of things to weigh. So we've been working on, you know, helping her get information. And one of the things that she did pretty early on was meet with an attorney to get information on how divorce works and what that would mean for her. She also has had, she's a woman who's traveled a lot, in really good physical health, really energetic, loves to volunteer. And over the past couple of years, has her activity level has really dwindled, and she's become really disorganized. And some information that I got from one of her daughters who referred her to me was that her disorganization was really problematically affecting her ability to function at home. So I did refer her to a psychiatrist who diagnosed her with pretty severe ADD and put her on meds, and the medication was helpful. What's also been helpful is working with her on her needs and ideals. This has helped her focus her time and energy. It's been really beneficial to her. She gets pretty scattered. I saw her today, and we've been talking about not multitasking, about being more focused on the things that are important to her. And she reported that she, it was Thanksgiving and she had a bunch of family, but she felt really good about her ability to do that over the past 4 or 5 days. So the plot and storylines, when she came in, her self-esteem was pretty in the toilet, and a lot of her beliefs were internalized messages from the ex. You know, that she wasn't interested in sex, and she wasn't good at keeping house, and so for these reasons, he had to have affairs. She had lost sight of really what had been meaningful and purposeful in her life, and had really just been focused in terms of her measurement of herself had come from him, and her self-esteem was really poor. Some of the interesting work that we did is that, and she was pretty open to this, about the conversations about, you stay in this marriage for a long time, and yeah, there were kids, but, let's look at the other reasons that that contributed to your staying in this marriage. And she copped pretty easily to the fact that it was financially good for her to stay in the marriage, that she was able to do a lot of things that she wouldn't be able to do necessarily if she was single. And then also there were some benefits in terms of not having to deal with intimacy when your husband lives on a different continent. And that there's some benefit in that for that in her. So in terms of deciding what to change, she worked on herself, worked on trying to understand him. The husband has been pretty engaged and pretty actively trying to get the marriage back together for the past at least a year. And her daughters believe that he's pretty sincere in his wish to work on the marriage. And she was back and forth and all over the board, and kind of the underlying thing that I focused on was getting her to have a good relationship with herself so that she could make that decision from a place of feeling good about herself. So she's come to the place where what she decided was that she really couldn't make a decision about the divorce because they hadn't lived together for a very long time, and that she needed to spend some time with him on a daily basis, and that she needed to do marriage counseling. And what she said to him is, I will live with you in Australia, because that's his next place, for 6 months. And I want my own bedroom, and we're going to have marriage counseling, and that's not optional. And the plan is for her to gather information and to see what it's like to live with him, and if he is committed, and if she can regain any sense of trust, and see if he can do work in therapy. And I have my own thoughts about that, but one of the challenges for me is to kind of keep my thoughts about what I would do out of this picture. So she's going to Australia in January, and her whole intention is to gather information, to see what it's like to be with him. She's found a nonprofit that she can volunteer for that she's really excited about, so she can have her life and get some information, try to figure out what to do about her marriage. So the new kind of story that she has declared for herself is that she, from here on out, chooses to be in relationships with people who honor and love her. And I really believe that she only was able to get there when she has been able to honor and love herself pretty consistently for the past couple months that we've been working together. And then the other thing is that I, Heather, declaration is I honor and reawaken my inspired and most adventurous self. And she has declared that after she spends time with her husband, figures out what to do with her marriage, she's going to Africa to work on water wells, which has been a long-time dream of hers. And she's young and healthy, and so that's she's going to do that whether she's married or single, and that's comforting to her to have that out there as an option in the future. So the identity piece, that's going to be ongoing. She's set the stage, she's a long way from consolidating, who she's going to be, and especially not knowing if she's going to be single or divorced, because that changes your identity in a really big way, in my experience. So that's Candace.
That's fascinating. Thank you very much. Are there questions that any of you have of Terry? Or comments? Terry, why do you think now she is getting more disorganized, depressed? I mean, it doesn't sound like things are remarkably different in marriage. Her daughters have grown. I don't understand why now.
So, why now is because she had been in Santiago, Chile, and there was an event with of actually being in the same at the same party with a woman that her husband had been involved with, and she got suicidal, and that had never had never been an issue for her.
Okay.
But that precipitated a lot of fear on the parts of her daughters and herself, and a lot of chaos.
Huh. What is your plan with coaching her going forward?
We're working on, she has a lot of tools, and she is really good at using tools. And the thing that came up today is that she said, I'm so damn angry all the time, and what do I do with that? So, there's another, toolbox to share with her about how to deal with anger. I'm going to be working with her through this month, and then she's going to be in Australia for 6 months, and I'm hoping that we'll Skype. But when she goes over there, it's going to be pretty much information gathering, and I suspect that we'll kind of back off at that point. And then when she makes a decision, I will support her and help her kind of solidify whichever way she chooses to go forward.
Would you like a recommendation?
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
I would recommend that you recommend strongly to her that you and she continue work by telephone while she's there, because this is a major change for her. It's a change in some substantial ways, because their attachment patterns have kind of fit together and enhanced each other. He has a avoidant attachment. She has an anxious, insecure attachment. And now suddenly they're going to live together and she's going to gather more information. I'm not sure she knows how to gather information, because neither of them have a secure, intimate attachment pattern, and they've had a maximum distance relationship. So suddenly they're going to be thrust together, and I don't think it'll last 6 months unless you actively work with her. I don't think she will be able to gather information without being overwhelmed unless you're working with her on a regular basis. Now, it's not undoable. I think there's a 12-hour. I've worked with two clients in Australia, and it's doable in terms of time. It's not convenient, but it's certainly doable. And I prefer telephone, because you don't have to have the iffy logistics of Skype. Since you have worked in person, you could easily move that to telephone. But I think that what she does in the next several months is going to make a major difference for the rest of her life. And I don't think that she has the tools and the information gathering machinery to do it by herself. And I think the terms of what information she gathers, how she deals with it, the decisions she comes to, and how that's going to be changing her story and her identity.
I think you're right. I have concerns about what I don't imagine that she's going to last there 6 months, but
yeah, I don't think she will either, but I think she will make it a meaningful, useful time, however long it is, if she has you to process that on a regular basis, because you can serve as an organizer for her, because she's not going to suddenly develop the ability, even if with medication she can focus, to develop a focused, cohesive system, and especially when that involves changes, when that involves the stimulus of being with this guy or living with him every day, because that's different. There are just too many things that are different, that she needs one anchor, one stable source, a point of reference, a beacon that you can be.
Good point.
And I would very assuredly and definitively recommend that you work together, that you think it'll you know, what she does and how she engages with herself, with her new story, that you can help her with that, and it's going to make a major difference for the rest of her life, what she does in the next several months.
Excellent recommendation. Thank you. And easy, really easy to implement with her.
Okay. I really believe you're the best thing she has going for her.
I think so, too. She thinks so, too. I mean, she's worked her little fanny off.
Then
she's
you can, with absolute confidence and clarity, make that recommendation.
Yeah, totally.
Okay?
Okay.
Well, let's do a follow-up. It'll be interesting to see what happens with her.
Yeah.
Other comments, other questions, or things to talk about with this really interesting case? Well, thanks very much, Terry. I think it was a fascinating case and an excellent application for coaching.
Thank you.
Yeah, super. Well, I want to keep the line open. I want to talk some about career story, and I want to talk a little bit about your clients. Let me just start, and I'll keep the line open so in case there are any questions or comments. Now, each of you is uniquely positioned to help a client navigate a career assessment and change. It's a familiar experience for each of us. We've each done it. As we discuss aspects of a new career story, reflect on your own experiences of transition to professional coaching, and you'll have a sense of resonance with your client as they navigate their own paths. Some thoughts first about passion and flow, and then I want to roadmap a new career story to look at how we can submit that to reflections along the pathway of roadmap. And then I want to discuss your coaching practice and marketing, some aspects of that that I want to comment about, even though we don't, you know, officially cover that, but there's some aspects in here in as we talk about our careers as well as coaching careers of others that might be helpful. First, about passion. Every success story is a love story. Bob Costas on Tim Russert's death captured his passion and his infectious enthusiasm. Costas said, he told me once, "Bob, besides my family, I don't want to be any place but here." All truly successful people live in alignment with their passions. They're fulfilling their purpose in life and living their dreams. Rick Miller's research on the key to happiness and peace of mind in his book Massive Success studied the secret of the world's wealthiest people to become successful. They may not know themselves. They may be caught up in what they do each day and be unaware of the elements of exactly how they become successful. But they have each discovered their why. They have aligned their purpose with their passion. And if we think about Terry's case, this is also, in one way of looking at it, a look at a career assessment. Her career has been to be the long-suffering wife. Now she's looking at changing careers and doing something different. So there may be some applicable aspects here in terms of what her career is going forward if we look at career broadly. The famous theologian William Barclay said, there are two great days in a person's life, the day we were born and the day we discover why. Consider the inverse. The number one reason people don't get what they want is they're not quite sure what they want. Now, let's talk for a minute just about flow. Flow is a state of heightened focus, productivity, and happiness. The ability to create flow, to be more productive, creative, and satisfied at work offers significant advantages. Flow is one of the positive states that's been studied in the last couple of decades in psychology, in positive psychology, that contributes so much to effectiveness and performance. And flow, from another perspective, is a state of mind of being centered and focused without distraction. It was my experience in the last month in being in New Orleans and being in the flow of writing. I get in the flow episodically, like for a weekend or a time when I'm out at my ranch or I get immersed in something, but to do it for the whole month, essentially, other than the training and the work with clients, that was an immersion. That was a very powerful process of flow and very creatively productive. Now, this state of mind allows full immersion in the process of concentration and performance that creates superior results. In the state of mind of flow, people engage so fully that they often lose track of time because the experience becomes its own reward, a way of countering distraction and becoming immersed in purpose. So now let's look at career and the perspective of career transition as an example of change and transition in someone's life. It's somewhat easier to talk about because career is more tangible and specific, but this is really about the dynamics of change and transition, but applied to career, and we'll talk about a roadmap that could apply to career transition of any type. So first, recognize your career story. And Terry, I want to encourage you to think about your client, you called her Candace, about what her career has been, her life, and being the kind of wife she's been, has been her career. She's considering a different career. Recognize your career story. If you were to configure it as a shape, what would it be? A trajectory, a circle, a bell curve, a flat line. Clearly describe your career story as it exists now. Then describe what you want in your career story. If someone wants to make a career change, are they fully informed about the one they're in now and wanting to leave? For example, if someone's only performed at maybe 80% capacity, concluded that their job or career is not rewarding, then decide to move on, they don't have the information needed. They can't make an informed decision of what it's like to operate at 100% capacity. In other words, they can't do an apples-to-apples comparison of what a new career would be like because they're obviously going to idealize a new career and compare that at 100% to their current 80%, not an apples-to-apples comparison. It's likely also that the same process that resulted in a ceiling at 80% would be repeated in the new situation. So a question for this aspect. At what percent of your capacity are you functioning in your work now? And amazingly to me, anybody I've ever asked that will immediately say a number. They don't have to think about it. They don't have to mull over it. They'll immediately spit out a figure, 65%, 80%. They'll tell you immediately. So the question then is, have you ever performed at 100% of your capacity? Do you know what it's like to be successful at 100% of your current or past position so that you can make an informed decision of what it's like to function at full capacity. Now, here's a brief story to illustrate. At the beginning of my career as a psychiatrist, when I was on the faculty of Baylor College of Medicine and director of the Baylor Psychiatry Clinic, I served as a little bit of my time as consultant for the Institute of Rehabilitation and Research, the institute here in Houston that Congressman Gabby came to after she was shot, working with people who had become physically disabled in adolescence or adulthood, often as a result of an accident. Now, not surprisingly, some of these individuals considered suicide as an alternative to a lifetime of disability. Instead of trying to convince them not to kill themselves, I indicated that I could understand their feelings about the overwhelming change in their life. Suicide was at least one way they could control something about their life, especially when fundamental body control was suddenly and traumatically not possible. And I recognized that at that moment in time, the idea of suicide, of being able to control one thing in their lives, to know they could end the pain, for example, was the hope that paradoxically allowed them to keep living. They needed that choice. They needed that hope to keep going. I recommended to each of them that we work together to achieve their full capacity now, recognizing that it was at a different level since the onset of disability. Only by achieving their full potential at their new level could they make an informed decision about whether they truly wanted to live or not live as a disabled individual. I told them that I would entirely understand if, after achieving full capacity and then being able to make an informed decision, that if they decided to die, I would respect that decision. I worked with several hundred people over a period of 5 years. Thankfully, no one decided to die after going through full physical and emotional rehabilitation and achieving a new, though different, level of function. Next step, own your needs and ideals regarding career. Be clear about your needs and ideals, if and how they align with passion. Yes? Was there a comment? Feel free to interrupt me, or if there's a question, ask a question. When your passion and expertise combine, wonderful possibilities emerge. So a question here is, what do you want in your career? Listen for whether the client is getting away from something or going towards something, or rarely both. My guess is, and this is just a vague hunch, that Candace does not know what intimacy in a relationship is. So she especially is going to need coaching to look at navigating that and even looking at what kind of relationship she wants, because each of them have different attachment styles, I think, and coming together to common ground is going to be a real challenge.
I totally agree.
Okay. Also in a career, distinguish temporary frustration from permanent dissatisfaction. Be cautious about confusing dissatisfaction, disillusionment, or a slow period with terminal disillusionment. Before you can distinguish temporary from permanent, you may need to realign or recommit to a career. Keep in mind that choosing the wrong career may be every bit as easy as it was the first time if you chose the wrong career then. One client, and I'll use her to illustrate a couple of points throughout. One client spoke of a particular storyline that she had bought into. She was not addicted to work itself, to money, or to the things that money bought, but she was addicted to the pursuit of perfection, to her work ethic. More had become a goal, more money, more work. The story, and in fact, it's the reason she initially consulted me, a doc who I had formerly trained as a medical student, as a matter of fact, had a thriving practice in another part of the country, had a number of physicians who worked for her, amazingly successful, and wanted to work with me to expand her success and develop her practice to an even greater level. The story of the pursuit of money had become a substitute for other stories. The ideal of more, of course, lacked an endpoint. So her self-esteem was never validated. She was always working hard, but feeling like she should do more and never satisfied. Because more is not a goal any more than perfect is a goal. You never get there. I'll return to her in just a moment. Next step, assess what is present and what is missing in the current career. What information do you need? Research new information regarding things like personal skills, abilities, aptitudes. A couple of questions here. What would your career and life be like if you already had what you wanted? What is it costing you personally and financially to not have what you want? And here, distinguish internal dissatisfaction from job dissatisfaction. Internal struggles and unhappiness are often blamed on a job or a marriage. People want to change the obvious external cause rather than to look inside. Sometimes people even create job-related struggles to externalize unhappiness or conflict so that when they can escape that, they pose a recognizable remedy, so they just leave the job or the person, and then ostensibly that's going to solve the problem. Next step, decide on a plan and how to make it work. So a question here is, how would working with me get you to where you want to be? Now, back to this client, I noticed a pattern with her that as soon as she was really enjoying her work, really immersed in it, she began procrastinating. She would put off completing things at work, which restored an old feeling of dread and vague guilt about what she should be doing. And when I pointed out this pattern, she recognized it. It prompted her insight. She said, well, work has always needed to be work. The minute I began to feel pleasure at work, I began to feel vaguely guilty because I should be working. Create a vision. Create a vision of success at your specific goals. Include all sensory detail, all experiences of successfully arriving at your goal. Review it twice a day. Having a plan supersedes motivation and not feeling like doing something. For example, your plan is that every Monday from 3 to 5, you work on marketing. You may not feel like it. You may not be motivated, but if it's Monday at 3 o'clock, you stick to your plan. And that's how you don't have to have motivation to do the things, especially that you don't like to do. You do them in order to get to where you do want to do. You substitute a greater pleasure than the pain of doing it, or a greater pain, which doesn't work as well, if you don't do it. Map your plan. Next step. Where, when, and how to begin. SMART goals, initiatives, next best action. Now, here's some compelling research that validates the impact of having a specific goal. Now, it's not exactly the research from a white coat sterile medical laboratory, but it's kind of close. The image of a black housefly was etched into each urinal at Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. The theory was that while men may not pay attention to where they aim, if they have a specific target, a goal, they will focus more specifically. The theory of the originator, Ad Kaboom, proved correct. It reduced spillage by just over 80%. Choice architecture is an art and a science. People can be nudged toward decisions that will improve their lives in healthy and wealthy directions. We are susceptible to biases that can lead us to make decisions that are unhealthy, uneconomical, short-sighted. When we consider how people think, we can design environments of choice that make it easier for people to pick better options. Next step, author changes. Implement the plan to reach the goal. Now, someone needs the correct paradigm. We don't quite talk about that enough in coaching. Changing careers means changing paradigms. A mistake of extrapolation would be to assume that a present experience would apply to a new career. You just changed the setting. And here's an example from one of my clients. Going from the head of HR at one mid-sized oil company to another in the same city, the person assumed that things would be essentially the same. Well, not so. The culture was worlds apart. The correct paradigm here would be not only the process, but the content of the new career, as well as the process of change itself. Assumptions within a paradigm need to be examined for correctness. And a personal example, you guys have heard me talk about this before, in making a transition from medical practice to coaching, I assumed getting clients would be similar to getting therapy and analytic patients. For me, that was to share my work and thinking, to occasionally present a paper or write a book. My secretary would take the calls and put patients on the schedule or the waiting list. Well, wrong for coaching. Coaching is a profession, but it's also a business. Marketing is a world of difference. And as I've mentioned numerous times, my mentor coach drugged me kicking and screaming into marketing. So a question here is, who else needs to be involved in your plan? Next step, last step, program new experiences to incorporate them into your identity. Considerations of a career need to be considered in conjunction also with the developmental phases of the individual within that career, as well as where the individual is in life development. Needs and ideals need to be considered in terms of life phase. The developmental issues more in the foreground of a certain life phase may determine how someone views a career, the challenges, or the desire to change careers. Here's how one transformation sounds. I'm astounded I could let go of the drama of being a suffering artist. Nothing dies harder than a bad idea. That was Julia Cameron in The Artist's Way. And one question, and you may have seen this from my blog, and I expanded this into an essay is one of the Engaging the Ineffables that I just wrote about in New Orleans, is the question that I ask the last group of CEOs, professionals who went to the retreat, what's next exact, to make a transition to look at what their next career or contribution will be. The question that most struck them, they said, of the entire retreat was when I asked them to immediately write down so that we could get an idea of their emotional response, not thinking about it and processing it through their left brain, to write down the first thing that came to mind. What is your unlived life? And these people who were paragons of success in every measurable way were astonished to find that there was a very prominent aspect of what they had been carrying with them that was unlived. So I'd think about it. I don't run in plays now, but I would think about. I wonder what Candace's unlived life is. So the process of coaching with your clients will parallel other processes. In other words, a client will bring alive the same attachment pattern, same kind of behavior patterns, the same issues. If a client is stuck in coaching, they're going to be stuck in their life and business. Where they're stuck in coaching will reveal where they're stuck in their life or business. If they don't fill out their paperwork in coaching, look to see if they're filling out their paperwork in their life. If they don't pay in coaching, look for the parallel process. If someone's frustrating you, look at how they're teaching others as well as you how to respond to them in that particular way, because you're not going to be alone. There are a couple of things I want to mention that I consider really important in coaching a new story. And since they sort of relate to career, I want to include them here. One is diagnosis bias. The moment that we decide something, that we label a person or a situation, just in our heads even, we then seek data to support that diagnosis more vigorously than data to contradict. This bias can include blindness to evidence that contradicts an objective assessment of a person or situation. Now, diagnosis bias is a mental shortcut in making decisions. It's a very useful way that we have of cataloging something. We don't have to go through all the steps each time. And once the shortcut of the label is there, we don't even notice things, though, that are outside the scope of this decision. And that's the potential drawback. The usefulness of this mechanism is evident because there's so much information that we're unable to take it all in or go through the process each time. But we have to be aware of what we may be overlooking. Now, closely related is the confirmation bias, in which we cherry-pick data to support our assumption. Now, here's one study, and this is an upgrade on the aesthetic scale from the last one, to illustrate. It's called the blind date. Psychologist Franz Epting devised a study to show how this works. His study sets up a blind date with a prior description of that person. A mutual friend describes the date as smart, funny, and interesting. If she says then on the date that her plans for the weekend are, well, it's what I do every weekend, stay home and read Hegel, the most common response was an appreciation of her intellect and a deadpan sense of humor. If the friend, however, described the date as smart, serious, and interesting instead of smart, funny, and interesting, the comment was more likely interpreted as, well, how much Hegel can one person read? And one person's comment captured the trend. Well, I ended up racking my brain about the difference between Heidegger and Hegel, and I decided to leave before dessert. The description determines subsequent perception. Now, very closely related to this is value attribution. We tend to imbue a person or thing with certain qualities based on the initial perceived value. And this is really about the role of assumption in action. And here's a study that I think illustrates this very nicely. Two economists, Barry Stahl and Hock Wang, studied skill categories and statistics of new NBA players, National Basketball Association players, beginning in 1984. They distilled their stats into three distinct skill measuring categories, scoring, quickness, and toughness. And they had the categories within each of these, like scoring was points per minute, free throw percentage, field throw percentage. So a very tight study, very good control variables. They looked at the variables that determined playing time in games. Skill categories, player's performance, and injury or trade status. There was one variable, though, that had greater impact than any of these actual performance data, and that was the player's draft selection order. In fact, draft selection order was more highly correlated with playing time through the first 5 years in the NBA, which is as long as they studied these statistics. So even though skill and performance determines a draft order, once picked, coaches and managers should be only interested in the player's performance. In other words, once the draft is over, the draft number is history and performance is everything. Not so, says value attribution. So I emphasize these two biases, particularly to look at keeping a very open mind in coaching and helping the client look at a situation with a beginner's mind as much as possible, looking at things with a fresh view. Now, any thoughts or questions about this? I want to move into some aspects of coaching practice and marketing, but I want to be sure that that this is clear and makes sense as an application for coaching someone's career transition or a transition that career can be an example for. Anything you'd like to talk about with this? Well, for your coaching practice now, you're not selling anything, you're offering value. There are two factors necessary to make coaching work. Your client is willing to grow, and there's a gap between where the client is now and where the client wants to be. The coaching engagement can be crystallized by focusing on one or both of these issues. What's the biggest challenge you're facing now? Where ideally would you like to be a year from now? When you bring value rather than selling or asking for a sale or closing, even asking for their business. As a professional, you make a recommendation. Now, this is, again, this is my preference and my thought about it. Think of other professionals, your physician, your dentist, your CPA, your financial advisor. They don't try to sell you anything, but they do an assessment, and on the basis of the assessment, offer a professional opinion and a recommendation. Then you choose to follow it or not. Now, same in my view with coaching. And this is totally a bias. Your professional, whether it's dentist or doc, doesn't offer you the platinum, gold, or silver package. He or she offers a professional assessment and a recommendation. You decide if and when. As a professional coach, you make a specific recommendation of how to work, the frequency, what's involved. This includes your fee, of how and when to pay the fee. And you know that my practice is a monthly retainer and payable before the beginning of the month and a recurring basis on online payment. Very few people choose to pay by check. Now, this is something that consistently comes up as I mentor coaches and other professionals, so I want to mention it briefly. There's a formula for determining your coaching fee in addition to where you fit in the market. When you think about it, there are only three variables: yearly income, number of clients, and your fee. If you pick any two of these that are the most important variables for you personally and professionally, you can calculate the third. For example, to determine what your fee will be. If you decide you want to make $200,000 a year in your coaching practice, that you want to work 11 months a year, and you want to see 15 clients each month on a weekly basis, then the calculation would be that you'd need to charge each client a monthly retainer of $1,215. Now, consider also that there are many other and different ways of delivering services in addition to individual coaching that can leverage time, value, impact, and income. Group coaching, facilitation, mastermind groups, teleseminars, seminars and workshops, webinars, speaking. There are additional services that you can also offer: a virtual firm with referral fees, or products such as e-course, paid website, book, e-book. You can create a tangible process for your coaching practice so that you don't even have to be present for it to be viable. Now, let's look for a moment at your business story. Each encounter with a client is a short story with a beginning, narrative, and an ending, and the memory that lingers on. Each professional relationship becomes a story arc of development. Your business is a story. Storytelling excellence is not something you just pick up along the way. It's an art, a craft, a discipline to be mastered. A story is a useful way to think of your business. What's the story of your business? Are the benefits clear? What's the story of your teleseminar, your training course? Is your story animated and engaging, effective, exciting, promising? Whoever has the best story wins. Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman, and he's written a recent book, a powerful book that I'd highly recommend, called Thinking Fast and Slow. It's about two parts of the brain. Now, I recently heard him present the findings that I'm about to tell you. Specifically, no matter how extended an event, whether that's a party, a commercial transaction, a presentation, or any encounter, we form our views and make our evaluations based on dramatically skewing two things: the most intense moments and the final moments. The final moments are particularly important because after an extended presentation or even dinner party, the way we remember something will be the few words or the brief exchange at the end. The great way that we felt retrospectively elevates the value of the entire experience. Or he gave an example of this. they had just sat through a tremendous symphony for 45 minutes. And right at the end, for about 1 second, there was a little bit of a screech of one of the violins. And at the intermission, that's all people talked about, is how the screech, how the violin really messed up the experience. And he thought it was profound that 45 minutes of exquisite pleasure and 1 second of unpleasure could dramatically skew the impact of the entire preceding event and experience. So, plan your story all the way through to the end. Make your story memorable, compelling, emotionally engaging. Consider your last impression. Beginnings matter. Endings matter. Memories are best created with balanced learning, right brain emotional plus left brain, reason and logic. Now, one additional thing I want to just mention here is for you to consider your brand in coaching. A brand is the identity, the personality of a product or business, the essence of your business story. It's not something that's going to be stated on your website or on your blog, but brand is an internal organizer for you to look at everything that you do to be sure that it's consistent with that. A brand is a valuable element of the identity of a business as well as of marketing. The brand is an emblem of the impression of a product or a company, a metaphor for expectation. Every part of communication, from the logo to the tagline to every communication, is going to be consistent with that brand. And think about the associations you have to brands. What's the first word or phrase that you think of for Nike? Probably performance. Everything that they do, their logo, every aspect of their marketing has to do with performance in some way. FedEx, on-time, dependable service. Oprah, inspiration, information to live a better life. As you go through your day tomorrow, think about the brands that really speak to you, the ones that cause you to buy and maybe later wonder why or later have to tell yourself why. Now, for your coaching business, you are your brand. Your mindset will define your brand. What's your promise? Your promise is, in essence, your brand. What's the opposite of a brand? Anyone? Generic. Our clients and potential clients consciously and unconsciously take notes on how we brand and value ourselves, how we charge what we're worth, how we handle the business of coaching. How we handle this will determine if we have clients and how successful we and they will be. So these are some things that I just wanted to mention to really emphasize the importance as you think through your coaching business and what your brand will be. There are some other things. Let me go through the other things and see if there's anything I want to dictate to send to you. But I want to conclude with a comment about money and value, and then just a very brief synopsis about successful productive work. These are just some assorted things to think about. We grew up with the idea that we have to work to earn money. Now, this may be among the worst ways to earn money. Figure out how to bring value to others, how to provide them your service or product, and you'll be rewarded. But you'll have to ask. Going to work should be for satisfaction, not for money. If you view your job as where you get your satisfaction rather than your money, you can set up different ways of serving people where you can earn money. You don't even have to be there. The key to making money is creating value and doing it consistently. People pay you when you add value to their lives. They reward you with what they feel the value is when you ask. Money is simply a symbol of that value. When you do a presentation or a sample session or engage a potential client, think, how can I add value to this person's life? So just, and I think this is in your outline, just some principles that relate to career that I've come to see and I wanted to conclude with. Time is not an adequate measure of hard work. Remember who in America has the best work ethic? A measure of hard work is not necessarily time, but the value you bring, the results that you bring, the impact. Hard work is not an adequate measure of performance or success. A work ethic is not the same as a productivity or success ethic. If possible, delegate everything other than what you do uniquely well. Time management is energy management. Stress regulation is energy management. Follow your passion. Know your optimum state of mind, your zone, to accomplish each specific task. Know how to enter your optimum state of mind, how to get to your zone. When your passion and your expertise combine, deciding possibilities occur. And finally, structure gives you freedom. Can we have just a few minutes? I'm interested in your thoughts, questions, and comments, things that you want to add or ask or discuss about anything that we've talked about so far. Terry, does this catalyze any further thoughts about your client?
It crystallizes, several different kind of paths that she's on and, metaphors to use with her. But here's a question that I have. Why do you think that, because as a psychologist, I never had to market ever. Either doing therapy or doing forensic evals, I never had to market. Why is coaching so different? Why is marketing involved so much more?
Well, that's a good question because it's a profession, but it's also a business. And the standards, the ethics, the culture of business really applies much more to coaching than it does therapy and analysis. That's why I had such a difficult time, because it was anathema to do anything that even hinted of marketing. So it's not like I just didn't know how to do it, but I had to overcome this very strong bias, because there were a couple of people in town who had big booming businesses, and they were marketing their businesses, and they were frowned upon by the blue chip shrinks who had an academic background and saw themselves as pure and pristine. So, what's your impression?
I don't understand, because it seems like the value is similar in terms of making a major contribution to somebody's satisfaction.
Yeah.
Did I just go? The value is similar. So I don't know the answer to that.
See, I think it's how we get to that. I think you're very accurate. I have seen people do dramatically better and over significantly less time in coaching. But think about the bar of entry. I think this is where one of the keys might be. To become a professional, you have a very standard set of procedures, and each profession has its guidelines, its ethics, its bylaws, its licensure. The bar of entry for coaching is really low. So anybody who calls himself a coach can call themselves a coach, and they're not in violation of anything.
Right.
So the people who engage in coaching are viewed very differently than the body of professionals who, say, are a certain kind of physician or or a CPA, because you know that the bar of entry to become a CPA is very rigorous. Not so with coaching, because people can go through a lot of rigorous preparation and a lot of work, or they can just call themselves a coach. So I think how you get there determines some of it, and it makes it more of an open market situation.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've mentored coaches who have gone through highly esteemed academic coaching, and there are only a few in the country. Most of them are on the East Coast. And they have a great deal of skill as coaches, but they haven't been educated about marketing in the business. They are lost about how to generate clients and how to make a business of coaching, and that's what I end up coaching them. And then, you know, I am impressed with the level of their skill as a coach, but the academic programs that are more first cousin to the professions, you know, do something very similar to what the professions do. And the professions do not train. Nobody ever talked to me in any way about how to operate a business as a physician. You just don't do
right.
that.
Right.
That was sort of anathema if you want to, you know, help people and make money at it, you know. So money became something you didn't talk about even. So I think it's a whole history of stuff. Well, thanks for all of your input. We do have to stop. And thanks for, again, a great presentation, Carrie. If the things that we didn't cover are things that come up, let's talk about it at the beginning of next time. Have a great rest of the week and look forward to picking up with each of you next week. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
See ya.